from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Michelle Martin, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Hanukkah starts tonight, and Christmas is just over a week away. And while you're home exclaiming over your grandma's latkes or your dad's fried turkey, you might also think about starting a conversation about the future, specifically sickness, death, and money. And that probably sounds awkward, to say the least, but a bit of discomfort now could save a lot of pain later. At least that's Amanda Brown's advice. She is a filmmaker and community organizer, but most importantly, a member of what was a large, tight-knit, and loving family. Those bonds have been broken in a family feud that began with her grandmother's stroke in 2009. She describes this in her short documentary film, Black Heirlooms. Here's a short clip.
Most important thing I've got from my family is just, you know, love of family. I used to brag about my family to other people. Like, yo, man, we got a great family. It used to be the Cosbys. Everybody educated, everybody, like, happy. So it was a great family.
This hour, On Point, Black Heirlooms, the short documentary film, and the tricky business of passing on wealth. You can join us on air or online. Could we be talking about your family? Have you had the awkward conversation about inheritance, or perhaps a constructive one? How did it go? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Amanda Brown. As we said, she has made a short film documentary about how her family was ripped apart in a struggle over her grandmother's care and her estate, a $51,000 estate. To watch the 18-minute short documentary, go to our website, onpointradio.org. And she's currently working on a longer version, and we're going to look forward to that. But for now, Amanda Brown, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Michelle. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you for doing this film. I think you raise a lot of important issues in it. And tell us first a little bit about Mima, your grandmother, and your grandpa. It seems like they did some remarkable things, especially given that they didn't have a lot of education themselves. As I think you mentioned in the film, neither of them graduated from high school. Do I have that right?
That is correct.
And yet they built this incredible legacy. Tell us a little bit about it.
They did, actually. That was one of the best parts about making the film, was just to be able to learn a lot about the history of my family. My grandmother is, as they say in the film, a very private person. And so a lot of her family background and a lot of my grandfather's kind of, a lot of their relationships she didn't talk a lot about. But piecing it together for the film became, you know, a really fun part of it for me. But neither one of my grandparents, like you said, finished high school. All of their eight children went to college. And my grandmother, my grandfather passed away before I was born. But my grandmother was very big on just the idea of family, family unity, education, you know, sticking together. That was her really big thing. My parents both worked. And so my grandmother was a huge part of my brother and I, our after school care, our weekend care. And so we were lucky enough to spend a lot of time with her. And she definitely, you know, beat us over the head with the idea, you know, of education first, you know, homework, aspiring basically just to do something with your life, to live something of value, to contribute not only to society, but back to our family.
So didn't graduate from high school themselves, had eight kids, all of whom graduated from college, and presumably the next generation did as well. But and they also managed to accumulate some assets at a time when that was not the easiest thing to do, particularly as African Americans. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, my mom and my aunts and uncles talk about my grandfather, how he, this is also part of the film, how he owned his own grocery store, he started his own cab company, he acquired property for a farm, and in addition to the profit or the revenue that he put back into the house, he also used that profit to expand his enterprises. And my grandfather came from a family of entrepreneurs. So when he moved from Arkansas to Oklahoma, he was living with his aunt, who actually had a grocery store. So it's in our family history to aspire to, you know, to create a legacy or to build something for our family. And when he passed, that went on to my grandmother. And some of my aunts and uncles have been bitten by the entrepreneurship bug as well. But up until this film, I think a lot of us kind of have played it safe until now.
So what exactly happened? I mean, the film doesn't make it clear to me, I have to say. What exactly caused the rift after 2009? I mean, I know that, you know, a $50,000 estate, just a cash estate, sure, that's a big amount of money, but it's not an enormous amount of money if you consider dividing it among eight people. So, and your grandma's still alive. I mean, she seems to still be recovering from the effects of the stroke, at least as we saw her in the film. What exactly happened? Why did the family get so, what were they fighting about?
She is still alive, and to clarify, the family is divided down the middle. So there are five siblings who actually see my grandmother, and there are three of my grandmother's children who haven't seen her in about 3 years since the last court trial. And so money is a catalyst, but I wouldn't say that it is the reason that the family was divided. It was just something for my mom and aunts and uncles to argue over, to have a disagreement over. And so the viewer actually takes the position of my cousins and I in not really knowing what happened. So there's, whenever you ask somebody, you get a different story. There's a different version. And so the short film picks up where the trailer leaves off without going into detail, because our parents still have never really clarified or given us a concise understanding of what happened. And
to that end, though, silence is in part a character of the film, isn't it? I mean, the failure to talk about things is in part the issue here. In fact, you know, I just want to play a short clip from the film. This is your mom, correct? Beverly Royal Brown, talking about your grandma, Meemaw, about how she chose to talk about things, which is actually very little. Here's that clip.
She's a private person, and what she has chosen to do with her estate planning is a matter of personal choice, and it's not something that she has made available for public disclosure.
But how then is anyone supposed to know what her wishes are?
That's characteristic of her generation, though. A lot of people, my grandmother just turned 90, and so a lot of people from her, they're the silent generation. And so they raise children to be seen and not heard. And so you model your life after how your parents live, and I think that they instill what they want you to know. And then the idea is that, you know, if we're smart, educated people, you know, we'll figure out the rest of it. But I am a millennial, and so my generation is very much about talking about it and asking questions and putting it, you know, on social media or even making a film about whatever we want to talk about. And
sharing.
So,
yes, sharing.
Yeah, just oversharing sometimes.
Apparently, some people feel you're oversharing. Apparently, I was going to ask you, do some members of the family feel you're oversharing? Are they not pleased to have this family rift?
Oh, absolutely. But I've tried to be as careful as possible to not delve into some of the very, very personal things that go into the background of my family. And because I don't think those things are important. What's important about Black Heirlooms is that there's a rift, and the details of that rift aren't important to the film, because they could be anything in anyone's family. Whatever your family rift is what it is. And so Black Heirlooms leaves it open for you to insert, you know, your family issues into that space.
To that end, you have been touring with the short film, and I take it you've been quite the response has been very powerful. A lot of people sharing their stories with you, their own family stories with you. Can you just tell us briefly just a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's the most popular response, is either people know somebody who have had their family divided over this type of situation, or they are that family. And so we went to Washington, D.C., Raleigh, North Carolina, Atlanta, Georgia, New York University, and Princeton University. And every conversation was different, but there is definitely an interest for people to talk about what happened to their family, as well as just people want to better understand how to prevent something like this from happening in their own space. And now, that's the reason for the conversation.
Well, briefly, and we're going to talk a little bit more about this as we spend more time together this hour, but you also connect your personal story to another story, a bigger story, about the racial wealth gap. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. The way that came about was just I wanted to understand what happened to, like, the Black wealth of old. So there was Black Wall Street, and there was a number of times in U.S. history when African Americans weren't, you know, so sensitive about the topic of money. And so I wanted to understand what happened between that space and now, which led me to Thomas Shapiro, Dr. Thomas Shapiro, and the Institute of Assets and Social Policy, and understanding the racial wealth gap, which is why we are at such a disadvantage right now, when at one point in time, we had accumulated a number of assets. And so for economists to say now that people of color, you know, are, you know, black families specifically are at the lowest rung, I wanted to understand more about that space.
Well, tell me just briefly, because we only have about a couple of minutes left and then we need to take a short break. And of course, you're going to stay with us for that. And we're going to bring in some other voices along the lines that you've helped us, you know, understand. But why would do you, is it your contention that this failure to or this inability to or refusal to talk about these things has left families vulnerable? Or is it that, I mean, is it that's, you know, exigent circumstances that if you have less wealth to begin with and emergencies occur, you need to dissolve that wealth in order to handle those emergencies? But your feeling is that it's a lack of planning and a lack of talking about things that has in part contributed to this?
Exactly. And when there's time for an emergency, it's a terrible time to be trying to piece together, you know, what you're going to do. It's a reaction as opposed to preparation. And in any case, whether that's in family or in business or in sports, that's a terrible game plan to go in with. It's dangerous. It leaves you, like you're saying, very vulnerable to being, you know, hurt or at a disadvantage.
This is On Point. I'm Michelle Martin, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about difficult conversations families need to have about estate planning, no matter how big or small the estate may be. And we're talking about what happens when they don't have those conversations. You can join this conversation. Do you have a will? If not, why not? Do you worry about jinxing yourself if you even talk about these issues with your family? We're talking with Amanda Brown, director and executive producer of Black Heirlooms. That's a documentary short film about how her family was torn apart fighting over her grandmother's estate. Let's listen to another clip from Black Heirlooms. This is Amanda Brown's cousin, Lindsay Erin Taylor, talking about how the fight over her grandmother's care and her estate has really affected her family. Here it is.
I'm Jackie, Uncle Gary, and Uncle Mac. They completely were like the black sheep in the family. And so there was only the five siblings and then their kids that were pretty much left that were considered family. I don't really know exactly what ended up happening with the money, who has access or did receive access to the money. But our family's just destroyed.
Amanda, that's such a strong word. It's so heartbreaking. I mean, to say that your family is destroyed, do you feel that way?
I do. I definitely think, and one of the hardest parts about it is just that it's not intentional. It's not intentional, but the family that we knew and the family that we grew up knowing and became accustomed to is no more. And it was sort of, you know, self-inflicted. So to destroy it, I think, is an accurate word to describe it.
Let's bring another voice into the conversation. Lori Ann Douglas joins us from New York. She is a partner at the law firm Moses & Singer, and she specializes in trust and estate law. Lori Ann Douglas, welcome to On Point. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Michelle. Thank you for having me.
Now, you just heard Amanda Brown's cousin and Amanda herself say that her family was destroyed over these issues. Is that a common scenario?
Yes, actually, it is. One of the reasons I became a trust and estates attorney is because as an African American, it was going to be a way that I could, you know, have a practice as well as assist my community because there are so few African American trust and estates attorneys. And it's crucial to have proper planning, not only estate planning, but disability planning as well, in order to prevent these family feuds. I think a lot of people.
I was going to ask you, though, do you find that people, I think some people might be surprised to find out that somebody who's got enough knowledge and awareness to even seek out a person like yourself are still having these problems. You know what I mean? I think a lot of people would think, well, these are the kinds of things that happen when people aren't even aware that this is the kind of thing that needs to happen. But that once you have the knowledge to deal with these issues, that you shouldn't be having these fights. And you're just saying that's just not true.
Well, no, it's, I mean, it's in every community. In the African-American community, perhaps, I think the last statistics I saw, a third of African-Americans die with a will. But in the community at large, only 50% of people make out wills. And it's a problem that people just don't recognize the importance often until it is too late, not only in making wills, but also in doing disability planning. I think it's important to point out, especially with Amanda's movie, is that this is not only about the fact that their grandmother didn't have a will, but it's also that she does not have in place medical directives and a financial directive, a power of attorney or healthcare proxy, because if those things had been prepared, then there would be documents that could assist the family in decision-making during her grandmother's disability. Remember, a will only takes its life after the person dies. And so, therefore, you need to have financial and medical directives. And those documents actually can really be created by individuals. Almost every state on their state websites have forms, statutory forms, and people can just, you know, print those out and complete them themselves.
Do you find, Lori, that many people don't feel that they need to do this kind of planning because they don't feel that they have enough money to make it worthwhile? I just want to play another clip from Amanda's short documentary. Once again, it's called Black Heirlooms. This is her Uncle Gary talking about how he sees these issues.
Black people look at wealth as just the white folks over there. Our wealth is in our little homes or our savings nest or our insurance policies. But you know, it's a cultural kind of thing because, see, we've never really considered ourselves as having wealth.
Lori, do you think that's true?
I think it has been true in the past, and I definitely think in prior generations it's very much true. I think as the African American community is gaining wealth, that attitude of we don't have anything to plan for is that attitude is changing. I just think people as a general group do not do estate planning as they should because it's just a difficult topic. People don't want to have to deal with their own mortality. It's often hard to look at your, you know, children and recognize their strengths and weaknesses and to plan accordingly for that. And so while there may be an attitude, especially in prior generations of, well, we just didn't have enough to plan, one, I think that's changing. And two, the reality is for the African American community, we are now acquiring assets and really do have to do planning. But the other thing about estate planning is it's not about the amount of the wealth. And I think the media often covers estate planning as if it's just for the wealthy and as if it's just something for people that need to do tax planning. What it's really about is planning for the transfer of whatever are your assets in a manner that will preserve the family, just as Amanda mm-hmm. talks about in her film. And so everyone has to do it. Everybody over 18, who, if you own anything at all when you die, it stays here and it has to go someplace.
I wonder, in fact, we should talk about this a little bit later, but what maybe it would be better if there was a different word, like stuff planning. Like, I don't know,
right.
Stuff planning.
It is stuff planning.
Let me just bring in some calls, though, because a lot of people want to participate mm-hmm. in this conversation, which, Amanda, is exactly what you intended, right? You wanted to get the conversation going, and you've done it.
I was just going to say that.
Okay, let's bring in Alfred. He's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Alfred, welcome to On Point. What's on your mind?
Hi, Michelle. Thank you. Yeah, it's an interesting show. I definitely have a personal experience with this because in the early 70s, my grandfather passed away, and the battle over the estate, which was only about $18,000, something like that, caused my mother and her sister to become estranged. And I grew up in this atmosphere of constantly squabbling over this tiny amount of money. And my mother and sister stopped speaking or having anything to do with one another. And this continued until the present day. And my mother just passed away this year. So it was
And they never spoke again?
They never spoke again.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Yeah, and I lost contact with that entire half of the family, too. I mean, I haven't been in contact. And in a weird way, out of a sense of, I don't know, some kind of strange loyalty to my mother or something, I have a really hard time trying to reopen that, you know?
I think
people,
go ahead, Amanda.
People under people underestimate the impact that their rift has on the extended family. And that's why I think it's so important that it is an intergenerational conversation, because like Albert is saying, the conflict was between his mother and his aunt, but it affects the entire rest of the family. Who should talk to who, like, what side are you on? That has a huge impact on the family dynamic.
Can I just briefly ask Alfred one more question, if he's still with us? Alfred, are you still there?
Yep.
Can I ask you, do you have any sense, and I realize it's been a long time, what the fight was really about? Was it really about the $18,000, or was it the sense that grandma likes this person more than me, or feeling dismissed or not important?
I think that there were aspects of it that it had to do with, my mother was a single mother. She was raising me. She had very little money. Whereas my aunt had more of a nuclear family. They were living in a suburb, and I think that there was a certain kind of family friction. Like I might have been on the more black sheep side of the family, and I think my mother resented that, and there was those kind of things.
I see. Well, thank you for calling, and I'm sorry for that, and I hope that that the relationships repair at some point.
Michelle.
Let's hear another call, because people are just eager to get into this conversation. Let's hear from Pam, who's calling from Newport News, Virginia. Pam, go ahead. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Michelle. What I'd like to recommend is, if you can possibly give what you have during your life, take the time to do it and explain to those who are going to be involved in the giving and the receiving before you pass on, because there is the suspicion of the person who is the executor of the estate. No matter what you do, you are suspect, because generational issues will be worked out and you will be the target of that, and the will will be target of that. Also, when my sibling passed away, he left a will. It was probated, and that's my question about wills. Do they all have to be probated? How do you protect yourself from being probated? And because he was dying, he knew it. He loved different organizations and different people. He tried to leave something for everyone, which made the executor have to do a tremendous amount of work, contacting the lawyers, letters written to the probate court, appearing in court, all sorts of administrative matters, stamps, letters.
I see. It was a lot of work. Well, thank you for that. Lorianne, can you answer that briefly? What about, first of all, tell us what that means, to have a will probated. What does that mean? And does every will have to go through that process, whatever it is that you're going to explain?
Yes. Well, it's always interesting. Probate is actually the process of authenticating a will through the surrogate or probate court. So if you have a will and your assets pass pursuant to a will, it always has to go through probate. That is the process. And so in order to avoid probate, one either has to own their assets in such a way that they pass by joint ownership or beneficiary designation or pay on death accounts, or you can set up other types of estate planning vehicles that are will substitutes, such as trusts. But there's no way to avoid probate with a will, because that's what the process is. It's called probate. If a person dies with a will, their estate goes through probate. If a person dies without a will, their estate is it's transferred under the laws of intestacy, and that's called an estate administration.
But can I just ask briefly, though, about her other point is that as an executor, I think she's feeling that, you know, the family did make plans, but the plans didn't necessarily resolve the tensions. And she feels that she was exposed to kind of a lot of suspicion and kind of resentment in trying to live out these wishes. Do you have any advice about how that can be avoided?
Well, to the extent that, you know, I do agree that if people have, you know, personal property, tangibles that they can give away before death, and that, you know, may be preferable. But obviously, you can't give away your money, what people need it to live. And so you're not going to have given away your, you know, your real estate or your brokerage account or your money in the bank. And so therefore, there has to be a system in order for it to be an organized transfer. I think it is true that an executor can often feel as if they've been put upon. But to the extent that the individual testator feels comfortable in discussing their estate with, you know, their family members, their loved ones beforehand, they will. But to the extent that they don't, the executor has the protection of the will, and the court system, once that will is admitted to probate, then the executor just has to transfer the property in accordance with the terms of the will.
Okay. Let me try to bring one more conversation here, because Amanda, this is something I think you're going to want to hear too. Mm-hmm. And Monica is calling, or maybe it's Monica, is calling from Boston. Monica, welcome.
Yeah. Hi, Michelle. I just wanted to add something to the conversation. I visited my extended family in Peru a few years ago, and over the course of, apparently there was a huge split within the family that I was unaware of, between basically my great grandparents and an estate. And in Latin America, I mean, it really is about land ownership, especially because times are hard with accruing work. So there was a divide between my uncle and my great aunt, and my mom had taken the side of her uncle, who she grew up with. And so for me, it was difficult because going into that environment, I was really unaware of the dynamics that were playing out and the fact that, oh, now we shouldn't visit my great aunt or one side of my family. And instead we're going to stay with the other side of the family. And this is family that they would visit us and in the States, and they stayed with us. And then all of a sudden it's like, we don't with them anymore. I think that's very
not just a black thing. Yeah. Monica, thank you for that. And Amanda, talk a little bit more, if you would, about, you know, what you're hearing. I take it in your tour with the film that you're hearing from a lot of different people with lots of different backgrounds who are experiencing this. It's not just a black thing.
Definitely so. And I just want to clarify, we get a lot of questions about why it's called Black Heirlooms. And I want to distinguish the difference between race and culture. So when we're saying Black Heirlooms, we're talking about black culture. And so to the caller's point, we all exist in different cultures. And so that's really important when having a conversation, is to bring in the cultural identity that plays into your community or your family. That's very important in, you know, the success of whatever is acquired or transferred. In addition to that, it's not, we get bogged down a lot in talking about things. And so that's why I wanted the film to focus a lot on why my grandfather and my grandmother acquired these things. Not only how they went about it, but my grandfather, you know, wanted to pay for his children to go to school. And so when you're an executor, or you're, you know, trying to decide about what happens to your things, your legacy and your culture should play a huge piece in that. And I think that makes it less morbid and less heavy, because it really is about, you know, what your life was about, you know, what you built just so you could help your future generations of family.
What are some of the reasons that maybe Lorianne, maybe this is a question for you before we take our short break, which we're going to need to do very soon. But what are some of the reasons that people hesitate to talk about these issues that you've heard?
I really think the main issue is that it's just a difficult topic. In the same, you know, while we're talking about, while there are definitely cultural differences that you sort of need to take into account when doing estate planning, it is universal that children and family members, everyone wants to be treated equally and fairly. And it may be that it you know, in order to, for the parent or the elder to treat the next generation in a way that they think is fair, the next generation may just disagree with that, because it's really, everybody wants to be equal. Mm-hmm. And there is often, you know, there's can't make people equal. There's often reasons that they should be treated, you know, unequally. And so I just think it's a hard conversation for a lot of people, but one that you have to have in order to accumulate wealth and to prevent family feuds and to preserve your family.
This is On Point. I'm Michelle Martin, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about inheritance, wills, and those tough but necessary conversations that we all need to have with our families, but too many of us are not having them. You can join this conversation. How do you talk about wealth? Have you mended an inheritance rift in your family? And do you have advice for families who are going through it now? We're talking with filmmaker Amanda Brown, director and executive producer of the documentary short film Black Heirlooms. It's about her family's painful split over her grandmother's care and her estate. Also with us, Lori Douglas, trust and estates partner at the law firm Moses and Singer. And, you know, in the short, in the film, Black Heirlooms, Amanda, to a point that you just made before we took a break, that this isn't just about stuff. It's about what you want for your family and how you feel about your family. I just want to play another clip from your film. This is a clip of Thomas Shapiro. He's an expert on wealth and poverty and a professor of sociology at Brandeis University. And he talks about the fact that, you know, wealth can take other forms. Here it is.
Families that don't have a lot of financial wealth, they often talk about their spiritual wealth, their family wealth, and they think about that conception of wealth as something that can help them in time of need or help them move ahead in some way or another.
That's one of the points of the film, isn't it, Amanda, that you're trying to get people to align what they put on paper and align their stuff with what they think about their families, right?
Right.
And exactly. What they want for their families.
Because it's so much bigger than just stuff. And I think that's what keeps people a lot of times from actually going through with it. Or I think that that's what adds to the misunderstanding is that we define all of these things differently. If you're the person who owns the legacy or owns the assets or owns the wealth, if you don't define your definition for everyone else, then it's left up to interpretation. And that's what happened to my grandmother, which was, this is what she wanted. This is what I know she wanted. And there's 8 different versions of what she wanted. Mm. And to an extent, some of those could have all been a piece of the truth, but the only person who really knows the whole truth is my grandmother.
I'd like to bring another voice into the conversation. Rakesh Kocher is Associate Director of Research at Pew Research Center. He's the co-author of their new report showing that wealth inequality has widened along racial and ethnic lines since the Great Recession. It's another topic that Amanda addresses in her short film. Rakesh Kocher, welcome. Thank you. Welcome to On Point, and thanks for joining us.
Hi, Michelle. Thank you for having me.
Now, your study shows, as I said, a widening racial wealth gap since the Great Recession. Why would that be?
It's a little hard to point to a specific factor, but, you know, the recovery from the recession has been rather slow, sluggish, and uneven. So we have seen a recovery in terms of employment, say, but we have not seen a recovery in incomes. And even during the economic recovery, the incomes of minority households have fallen by 9% in the 2 surveys we looked at, whereas the incomes of white households were more or less stable. So that could be one reason that you still have to draw down on your assets, or you have an inability certainly to add to your existing assets.
You write in the report that the wealth of white households was 13 times the median wealth of black households in 2013. That is compared with 8 times the wealth in 2010, according to this new analysis. And you also say that the wealth of white households is now more than 10 times the wealth of Hispanic households, compared with 9 times the wealth in 2010. Where do African-Americans and Latinos tend to have their wealth concentrated?
For both Hispanic and black households, the principal asset is an owned home. And among Hispanics and blacks who do own a home, more than half their wealth derives from that single asset. Whites have slightly more diverse portfolios, more likely to own stocks, more likely to be in jobs that offer decent pension benefits, so they're more likely to have money in 401ks and so on. In addition, there's an asset ownership gap. Nearly 3 in 4 white households are homeowners, but less than half of black and Hispanic households own a home.
Mm-hmm. Now, Amanda Brown's made the point in her documentary that part of what is contributing to this racial wealth gap is a lack of planning and a lack of determination about how, or lack of clear instruction about how what wealth is accumulated is passed on. And I realize that that's not the subject of your research, but I wondered if you could shed some light on that yourself from the work that you've been doing.
I am not totally familiar with this firsthand, but I am aware of research by others that points to a lack of financial literacy among certain households, especially among Hispanic households who are recently arrived in the country and face language barriers, or otherwise they bring different cultural habits with them, a lack of trust in financial institutions perhaps. So the lack of financial knowledge and the lack of overall participation in the financial sector could be an issue.
And just finally, to another issue in your survey, you said that financial assets such as stocks have recovered in value more quickly than housing since the recession ended, and that people of color are more likely to have their wealth in housing than in these other types of assets. That's going to have an effect. Is that correct?
Yes, it certainly means that white households were in better position to benefit from the recovery in asset prices. Stock prices increased nearly 35-40% during the recovery, but home prices have recovered much, much more slowly.
Well, thank you for that. Thank you for sharing your insights. That's Rakesh Kocher. He's Associate Director of Research at the Pew Research Center, co-author of their new report showing that wealth inequality has widened along racial and ethnic lines since the Great Recession. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
So, Lori, let's come back to you now. Is this something that you've seen in your own practice?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that interesting, or one of the things that maybe is a cultural fact in the African American community, like we've discussed, real property ownership is valued, and people recognize that owning real property is a way of, you know, creating and accumulating wealth. But one of the things we have to remember, when somebody dies, real property has built-in costs that continue to go on, that if there is not, you know, money to fund those costs, the next generation has to pick up those costs. In addition, real property, if it's a large asset, there could be estate taxes due at the time of death, in addition to, you know, the individual's final income tax return is due and real estate taxes become due. And so if there hasn't been a way to prepare for the expense related to the property, it often results in a sale, sort of maybe a fire sale, because the property can't be maintained. So I think one of the things that we have to look at is teaching, you know, financial literacy, and teaching ourselves in the African American community that while home ownership is important, there are other ways that to accumulate wealth, and, you know, being in the stock market, buying, you know, bonds and other financial assets is a way to accumulate wealth, and all of that then has to be considered, and how is that going to be passed along, whether it's going to be by beneficiary designation, where the money just goes straight out to someone and therefore it's not in the estate to pay other expenses. And so all these things sort of have to be, you know, we have to learn about it, and we have to really start to do these things and focus in a more concerted effort.
Let me bring in another caller. This is from Austin, Texas, and this is a person who has, I think, an experience that is common to a lot of people these days, which is a blended family. So, Deborah, welcome to On Point. You're on the line now. What's on your mind?
Hi, Michelle. Well, two things. One is that, as particularly the attorney talks, I've lost both my parents over the last 15 years, and I cannot tell you the greatest gift that anyone can give their children and their extended family is complete estate planning, because then you can – somebody else is taking care of dotting all the I's and crossing all the T's while you're working through your grief, and I think that really helped my brother and I. But with respect to a blended family, ours has now been blended for 25 years, but when I married – my stepchildren were very young, and my husband and I had one more child, a daughter. And as the children have now all reached the age of maturity, they're adults, we have rewritten our wills to divide everything equally among the three of them, despite the fact that they are not my biological children. I can't help but think that if they were to lose both their parents, the last thing they would need after all these years would be to say, Deborah didn't really love us as much as she loved you. So even though they may inherit additionally from their mother's family, we have made a conscious decision that we have three children, and since I have raised them, you know, for the last 25 years, they are as much my family as our biological daughter is, and we've divided everything and kept our wills up to date. So that it's divided three ways.
Well, I appreciate you're telling us a story that is not so terrible and miserable, kind of balancing the scales here, that there are some good stories here. Can I just ask you, Deborah, have you told them this? Have you told the children
Absolutely.
This?
Absolutely. We they were very young when my mother died. My mother died at 60 from cancer. So they have seen their grandmother die, their grandfather remarry, their grandfather die. And as they have all reached the age of 18, particularly my oldest son, we had to talk to him about whether or not he wanted to be responsible for his sister. He's now almost 30, involved in, being executor. And so we're actually in the process of updating a third time because my daughter is now approaching the end of her education.
That sounds like you're really on point with that. So thanks, Deborah. Thanks for sharing that story. Can I just bring in one more call from Josh from Austin, Texas? Josh, welcome.
Hi. Hi. My comment is just with regard to the way my dad set up his trust. He named my oldest sister and me as trustees and also as executors of his estate. The whole process, while it was laborious, resulted in bringing the siblings very close together because we decided that we were going to over-communicate everything that was going on with the trust. It was a 10-year duration of the trust after death. And it brought everybody together. We were in charge of paying out earnings while the principal remained protected. And at the end of 10 years, we distributed the principal between the siblings and the grandchildren. And we developed the trust from our siblings and our other beneficiaries by being very transparent and administering the trust squeaky clean. The trust included a clause that said that we could compensate ourselves for the time that we invested, but we chose not to do so. We just charged some certain expenses.
Sure.
And it just was a wonderful experience that brought all the siblings and the grand siblings together. So,
well, thank you for that. Well, thank you for sharing that is possible as well. That was Josh from Austin, Texas. I'm glad to have that perspective as well. Amanda, we only have a couple of minutes left, so I wanted to ask if I mentioned at the beginning of our conversation that you know there's some unhappiness in the family. You're airing these issues. I do wonder because you do say in the film that the third generation, you know, the cousins are trying to stay communicative, even though their parents, the aunts and uncles, the brothers and sisters, are still beefing. Do you have hope that this rift will be reconciled at some point? And I wonder, you know, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I do wonder if just getting it out on the table in the form of this film, do you think that might be actually help bring everybody together?
My cousins have said at some of the events, they've sat on some of the panels and said that they found it very therapeutic. But the point of the project isn't to reconcile my mom's, like, the second generation. I think that what they have is something that they have to fix on their own. And so what my cousins and I have done is tried to, we talk at the end of the short film about us forming our own trust to make sure that whatever happens with the generation before us, that it doesn't put us financially or socially at any sort of, you know, inequality or disadvantage because of what's happening with them. And so I also wanted to point to something that Deborah said, which was the reason that I bring the wealth gap into the film is not it's basically to point out that there's a sense of urgency and the idea that we are wasting assets based on what could be deemed as, you know, petty arguments or personal conflicts is putting people at a disadvantage in education, in being able to purchase houses, and it's squandering legacies that have years and years of years of work have been put into building. And so it's not only morbid, but it's extremely important. And so that's what my cousins and I are focused on.
Well, speaking of building a legacy, though, I did want to give just a minute to say that this is a short documentary film. It's 18 minutes, but you have taken steps to create a longer film through a legacy building mechanism called Kickstarter, right? How's that going?
We did a Kickstarter earlier this year in April. We had a goal of $23,000 in 30 days, and we actually surpassed that. Thank you to all of our backers. We ended up with $33,817, and that went to the short film, the tour, and we're also building a multimedia website that we're working to secure a partner to finish that next year. We're also in the final phases of editing our full feature film, a full-length feature, which would be 70 to 80 minutes. That'll be out in 2016. And next year we'll continue to tour and do the wealth panels. And I think we're also working on a research project. So there's a lot of good things that have come out of this project. It's been an amazing year, but there's so many more great things that we have to do.
Well, congratulations. Thank you so much for sharing this with us. That's great. And we look forward to more good things and more important conversations. That's Amanda Brown, director of the documentary Black Heirlooms. You can go to our website, onpointradio.org, to view the video. Amanda, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle.
Also with us, Lori Douglas, partner at the law firm Moses and Singer. Great to have you with us as well. Thank you so much for your work and for your insights and for being willing to share your insights for free this time. We didn't have to pay you for your advice. So that's always good. Lori, thank you for coming.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, from the Sochi Olympics and Ray Rice to LeBron's return to Cleveland, we will unpack a big year in sports. I'm Michelle Martin, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.